comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to Talk Radio Like Nowhere Else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. We've got some interesting, nothing earth-shaking, but some interesting things that will be taking place in the northern latitudes. Starting tonight, the scientists who watch the sun say that starting tonight, the aurora, you know, the northern lights, should get a little boost up as a result of a coronal mass ejection that took place on Friday. So, you know, if you live in the northern latitudes, you should be getting a little bit more spectacular light show starting tonight for, you know, a period of time, a small period of time. So, you know, and those of you who are visiting in those upper northern latitudes and you've never seen that, you might want to get out there and take a look at that tonight, because it's supposed to start increasing starting tonight. For those of you who are brand new, you don't know about it, but we have a free weekly newsletter called the K-Files. And so if you're brand new to the show, you've never been here before, you've never heard of that. The K-Files is emailed out to all of the subscribers starting on Friday night after the show, every Friday night. And we'd love for you to be getting in on that. It's absolutely free. There are no strings attached. Really, I know we're all in shell shock from internet doublespeak. Well, just from doublespeak. I mean, that doublespeak has become the norm, I guess, around the world, but there's no doublespeak here. And so when we say free, we actually mean free. And no strings attached, we actually mean no strings attached. So if you're not subscribed to the K-Files, be sure you get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and subscribe. You do that by clicking where it says K-Files. It's the biggest link on the page, right in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. And it takes only a few seconds, and then you're subscribed, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Also, if you're new here, you don't know about what's the deal with the members area. See, it's absolutely free to listen to the show. Not all shows out there are free to listen to on the internet. Obviously, those of you who are listening via AM, FM, shortwave, cell phones, it's always free to listen. But I think most of you know that a lot of the big shows charge you to listen to the show on the internet. Well, we don't. You can listen absolutely free. However, we do have a members area, and it isn't free. It isn't expensive either. It's probably the best value on the internet anywhere, 23 cents a day. Now, what you get in the members area is way too much for me to list everything here right now, but I can tell you a couple of things. First of all, if you're a member, you could be watching this show live right now. You could be. And let me just check something. Yep, no problem. It's out there and people are watching it. So you could be watching the show live. You could catch this show later and watch it. You could get our free ebooks that are in the ebook library, our forums, lots and lots of stuff, your own profile page, messaging. Why don't you join? We'll be back with Michael Teller right after this.
And you are smart because you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, Michael Tellinger. Now, Michael Tellinger has been with us before. Now, the last time he was with us, he was actually way out in the middle of the wilderness, and it was difficult to do a phone connection, but we did it. And but he is not in the middle of the wilderness. Well, some people might say so. I think probably people from Houston or Fort Worth would say he's in the middle of the wilderness. He is in a place called Dallas, Texas. He is on tour here in the United States. And Michael Tellinger, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you're here.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's lovely being in Dallas. I've had a fantastic day since I've arrived earlier today. Just got back in after having a wonderful dinner in one of the fantastic suburbs and restaurants. And I picked up, as I told you off there, such a positive, incredibly positive energy from the city. I can't wait to wake up tomorrow morning and just go out and experience a bit more of this fantastic town.
Well, you know, I always like to hear things like that because that's my hometown. That's where I grew up. And I've got family over there, and I've got friends over there, and naturally, I think it's a great place. But it truly is. You know, Dallas has a flavor, an atmosphere about it that's different from any place else in Texas. And it's hard to describe, but it's something you notice immediately once you get there.
Yeah, I certainly feel that.
Michael, you know, one of my great interests is ancient civilization and everything that goes with that. I mean, when we talk about ancient civilization, I think a lot of times people are thinking, you know, ancient remains of ancient buildings and things. And that's part of it. That's part of it. And other artifacts, that's part of it. But when you talk about ancient civilization, you're talking about real flesh and blood people. And they had a society. They had a culture. They had norms. They had things that occupied their interest. And the more that we can find out about these people, I think the better off we are at understanding who we are, because that's where we came from. We're descendants of these ancient people, and you have been working in Africa with what has been called the largest, most mysterious ancient city on Earth. And I'd like for us to just dive off into that a little bit, but before we do, I'd like for you to kind of give us an update on this tour. What are you, is this what you're talking about on the tour?
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm in the USA, is to start introducing the people of the United States. I've been doing this for the last 4 years or so in South Africa and in some of the Southern African countries, and also in the UK for the last 2 years, spreading the information of the discoveries of this vanished civilization that lived a long time ago at the southern tip of Africa. And we're looking at a civilization that goes back about 300,000 years. Now, when you say that kind of word to archaeologists or anthropologists, it sends shivers up their spine, because they're not normally used to these kind of numbers in antiquity. But that's what it is. That's what our evidence shows us, and that's what the scientific clues and evidence is providing us with. And so I'm here in the USA to spread this information, and I'm on a 26-stop tour. I'm in Dallas tomorrow. We're at the Spiritual Fitness Center, which is at 300 North Coit. I'm not sure how you quite pronounce that.
You said it correctly.
North Coit in Richardson, and I believe it's northern Dallas. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Spiritual Fitness Center, and we're there from 6:30. It's a three-hour-long presentation. And what I talk about is a broad overview of the road to discovery and all the different principles that cross wires, which is the most exciting thing about these discoveries, when you start seeing how what we are discovering now pulls in all the different elements of research, from astronomy to ancient history to mythology to religion to ancient civilizations, and it pulls all of that information together and finds that we have a common denominator in these ancient vanished ancient civilizations in southern Africa that seem to be the prototype civilization for all the others, including the Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Olmecs, and everyone else you've ever heard of.
All right. Now, this place that I mentioned is not very far from the location that you have called or that has been named Adam's Calendar. And it's an area larger than modern-day Johannesburg. It's been called the largest, most mysterious ancient city on Earth. Does it have a name?
Well, at this stage, it doesn't really have a name yet. We did give the ancient stone calendar that was discovered, or should I say rediscovered, by my colleague Johann Heiner, in 2003, we called that Adam's Calendar. And now, after 7 extensive years of research, starting with really basic, you know, measurements to more advanced archaeoastronomy, to studies in geology and observations and in various scientific principles, we now believe that Adam's Calendar is actually the work of what the Sumerian tablets refer to as Enki, the Sumerian entity called Enki, which comes as a great surprise to many and a great joy to others who have been following the work of people like Zechariah Sitchin and other translators of the Sumerian tablets.
All right, what is there about this location that has led you and your team to think this may actually be some of the handiwork of Enki?
There are so many things, Kevin. This is not an easy, 5-minute situation that you try and decode. It took us, Johann discovered the site in 2003. It is not a new site. The calendar has been known among the ancient African traditions for many thousands of years. It is referred to as one of the 2 most sacred sites on Earth. And in even an African tradition, it is referred to as the home or the place of Enki, who is the African name for the Sumerian Enki. So that is just as a point of departure, in case there are any doubting Thomases out there. Ancient African knowledge goes back many, many thousands of years. Many people are not aware of this. And a lot of very important information has been kept and transferred by the medicine men and the wise men of Africa that have passed this down through generations and for millennia, and just like in every other ancient culture and every other ancient civilization. So the reference to Enki comes to us in African tradition as Enki, and that Adam's calendar is in fact his construction. And then we, in the Sumerian tablets, we get direct links to the same entity and the same being building this kind of structure. And slowly but surely, we start building a body of clues and evidence, just like the guys in CSI do. I like to use that as an example. We collect every piece of evidence that we have from a scientific perspective and put it together and then examine it and start structuring or putting together a hypothesis and an argument for what it is that we're dealing with. And that's really exciting, very exciting work. And it comes to us now that we've reached this particular stage we're at. The information is coming so fast and so furiously that it's almost difficult to contain it.
Is this your first American tour?
Yeah, it's my first American tour.
Okay, here's why I'm asking this. The information that you just shared with us is to me, just fascinating information. It's great. I'm, you know, this is the kind of thing that really, as we say in the South where I grew up in Dallas, that melts my butter. I like this kind of stuff. But I'm curious, how is it being received so far here in the United States as you tell people about this?
Well, you know, fortunately, I guess, people instinctively know whether you're lying to them or whether you're telling the truth, whether you're speaking from the heart. And so far, because that is what I do, everything I convey and everything I share with people is information that has come to us through hard work over several years, well, 7 years, at least 7 years, as I said. And Johann Heine, at least 25 years of work. And so it's real, it's a compilation of evidence that we speak with absolute honesty and from the heart, and it resonates with people. They know that you're telling them something that is crucially important as a body of evidence to try and uncover the origins of humankind and find these clues that the three questions that have been haunting humanity for so long: who are we, where do we come from, and why are we here? Seemingly very simple questions, but have been the three most difficult questions to answer in the last few thousand years. And we're starting to now find the physical evidence that are leading very, very quickly to understanding who we are as a species, how we ended up on this planet, and what it is that we're doing. And once you understand that and it becomes clear to you what's been going on this planet with ancient civilizations, it becomes a lot easier to start to understand where we are heading as a civilization today. So we've been received with great enthusiasm. I was in Austin 2 days ago, and Austin was at, last night. I was in Austin yesterday. I did my presentation there yesterday. And it was just so enthusiastically received that people didn't want me to go. They wanted me to do another talk tomorrow somewhere else. And this is what's happening. It's just snowballing so incredibly. It's amazing.
I'm glad to hear that. I really am glad to hear that. You know, Austin has a motto, and this is not a joke. Their motto for the city of Austin is "Keep Austin Weird." That's true, and you'll see it on signs around Austin. All right, right at the beginning, I talked about how civilization, an ancient civilization, it's more than just the ruins of the buildings, although those are fascinating. But it's finding out things about these people and their lives, their activities, their art, their culture, sometimes even their music in some ancient locations. What are you finding out about these people at this location?
Well, that actually is when it starts to hit home that we know very little about our human history. And I just want to tell you, for the sake of your listeners, you know, we get taught all the time that history is written by the victors. And these are one of the many idioms that get shoved down our throats on a daily basis and at school, at university, and so forth. And there are many more, but the history is written by the victors is one of the most common ones. And you've got to really take a step back and ask yourself, well, okay, well, if history is written by the victors, what exactly does that mean? And if you just do a very basic mathematical equation of what it means, you start getting shivers up your spine, because you realize very quickly that within a very short period of time, we have completely and utterly eroded our knowledge base of our own history. And I show this in my presentation, and it's a great shock to the system when you realize that at this stage of our civilization, some 6,000 years after the start of the so-called first civilization in Sumeria, which is not true, by the way, we know absolutely nothing, zero, less than zero, about our human origins. And that's a huge shock to the system, because as the civilizations have come and gone and conflicts have come and gone, the truth has been eroded and changed so much that it's almost impossible to trace it back. So what we are discovering in South Africa is quite a shock to the system about these ancient civilizations. And what we at first thought were basic stone circular structures and very naive buildings that are, you know, there are millions of them, by the way, and we can talk about how many there are just now. What we're finding is that these ancient civilizations had an acute knowledge of advanced technology and an understanding of advanced technology that we have very little knowledge about. And they used this technology for everything they did, from mining gold, and they were there mining gold, and once again, we need to talk in greater detail about this. They were there mining gold and other minerals, and they had thousands of miles of crops, of agricultural terraces, and we're finding strange tools and artifacts that previously have not been recognized in archaeology that just make no sense. And this all points very distinctly towards a vanished civilization that we know absolutely nothing about, from which all the other civilizations have emerged that had this advanced knowledge of, especially the use of energy. And this is where it becomes very important, because today the quest for free energy and using energy and zero-point energy and universal energy and you know, all these new energy sources that we're desperately trying to find, I believe that we found them already, and many people do that, but they've just been suppressed. These ancient civilizations knew this, and they used this free source of energy.
All right, we have a break looming in front of us, and I don't want to get in to something deeply and then get cut off, so I will hold my next questions until after the break. But you know, one of the things that struck me, I went to your Facebook page and looked at some of the photographs you have there, and one of the things that struck me is the photograph from the air of these circular structures. And the connecting roads, et cetera, this looks like something that we would see in a photograph from Mars. But I'll let you address that when we come back on the other side of this break, because we have to step away for a moment or two. We'll be back, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Michael Tellinger, and we're talking about these ancient ruins that he's been, for years now, 7 years, he's been involved with discovering what they're all about. And I believe you said your working partner there, what's his name?
His name is Johan Heiner.
Johan, he's been at it for 25 years.
Yeah, well, Johan started really photographing these structures from the air. He's, you know, he runs the big firefighting company in South Africa for forestry. So he's had the benefit of flying around for many years, looking down at all these structures, you know, thinking to himself, what the hell are these, you know? And most of them have been at the tops of mountains, the most beautiful examples of these circular stone structures. And he started photographing them a long time ago, about 25 years ago, and bringing it to the attention of the authorities. And over and over he's been told, oh, it's nothing, don't worry about it, it's just some, you know, cattle kraal, that's what they call them, you know, for the local tribes to keep their cattle in, and it's of nothing, no historic value, just ignore it, don't worry about it. fortunately, he didn't give up. He carried on photographing them, and then he started measuring them and realizing that they were aligned with sunrises and solstices and equinoxes and north, south, east, west, and other interesting geometric shapes in them, that we suddenly realize that they not only have the alignments with the sun movement, but also are deeply encoded in with sacred geometry and in things like the phi factor, and you realize that this is not, you know, a stroke of luck, a coincidence. There was a civilization here that had an advanced knowledge of all this stuff and encoded it in these structures.
All right. Now, you mentioned before we went to break, you mentioned that the civilization that built these things quite obviously had advanced knowledge, perhaps, certainly technology far advanced of what we would have imagined, and advanced knowledge, including knowledge of energies. Now, I want to get to that, but people that are watching on our TV channel are seeing the aerial photograph that you had, that you have on your Facebook site. And this looks like something that we would see in a photograph from Mars. And this is a little bit of an aside question, and we don't have to spend much time on it, but have you looked at any photographs from Mars or other heavenly bodies and seen something that to you said, this looks like the same kind of structures, and perhaps there was a civilization there?
Well, you see, this is where it gets even more interesting and more exciting. Because when you do this research, you very quickly realize that you've got to start looking for clues and evidence in all other and strange and wonderful places that many scientists or researchers or academics, especially academics that are linked to, you know, established institutions, would be normally very uncomfortable looking in those areas. Fortunately, I'm an independent scientist, an independent researcher, and I look for clues and evidence everywhere. And that is exactly where our research takes us. It takes us to evidence that presents very strong clues and, well, information that presents evidence of extraterrestrial activity. As you say, something that might have come from Mars. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. And, you know, if this is a big shock to many listeners, we live in a world where our history is a lot stranger than most people could possibly realize. And fortunately, the archaeological and geological evidence is there. It does not lie. What has been happening, however, is that established institutions have taken, over hundreds of years, taken especially the last several decades, and the last 100 years, have taken a lot of very important information and hidden it out of sight because it's a bit too controversial, and they don't really want to discuss it because it starts to implicate activities of other beings of earthly origins. And if this is what the evidence shows us, then this is what we need to deal with.
What are some of the things at the site there in South Africa? What are some of the things that you have seen that to you indicate some interaction with or presence of extraterrestrials?
Well, to answer that, you've got to really look at the full spectrum of the things that we're finding. And what we're finding is the largest human settlement ever constructed on Earth, larger than all the major cities of the world today put together. Now, that'd be a shock to most people. But we're dealing with a stone-structured settlement that runs for thousands of square kilometers and consists of over 10 million stone structures and stone ruins, which is a discovery that I made after I realized that these things are not just incidental, and they're actually linked, as you mentioned, by these ancient roads, what we originally called roads and terraces. and that even though sometimes you can't see them, they are still there, but they're covered by soil, and soil and sediment. And when you start researching that, you realize that these structures have been covered by soil and sediment, what seems to be this thing called the flood that the Bible refers to, the biblical flood, and every other ancient civilization talks about the same event in various ways and forms. And we realize that we're staring into the physical evidence of a civilization that existed before the flood and consisted of millions and millions of structures and supported a population of probably 50 million people or more. And they were all there for one reason only, one reason, and that reason is gold, mining gold. And this is the thing that is inextricably linked to the origins of humankind, man's obsession with gold. And not only man's obsession with gold, but before man became obsessed with gold, it was the gods. In every ancient civilization, it was the gods that were obsessed with gold. And now we start looking at, well, who are these so-called gods that the ancient civilizations talk about? And you need to very quickly draw a distinction between these so-called gods, that I call gods with a small g, and God, the divine creator or the divine entity that's responsible for the universe and the creation of the universe and so forth, the divine being, if you want to call it that, or source. There are many names for it, but if you just use the word God, it could get a bit confusing. And you need to draw a very, very strong line between those. So the divine being or the divine God is not a few gods with a small g, which were just advanced people that had the knowledge of flight and knowledge of advanced technology that settled on Earth and came here to mine gold. And this is where all of our ancient civilizations point to the same activities. And it's staggering that now we're finding the evidence of these first settlements of these people, and we're talking about millions of people all participating in the activity of mining gold.
And all right, now, this huge settlement of people, as you've described for us, has an interesting feature, and that is stone walled streets yep. that on both sides have stone walls. How high are these stone walls?
Kevin, the streets that you say, we when you start looking at them from the air, as you mentioned, for people that are looking at the website, and we've got several websites that show those photographs, and also in our new book Temples of the African Gods, we go into great detail about this. But those roads run for thousands of kilometers and thousands of miles, linking, originally, all the stone circles were linked by these so-called roads, which now we call channels, but not roads, because they're not really roads, because they weren't paved, but they were walled on either side. That, as you said, they had these two walls that run parallel for thousands of miles, linking all these stone circles together. And some places they are completely eroded, so they are just level with the ground. Some places they're still 1.5 meters tall. All depends on where it is and how well it is, how far out of modern man's way it has been for all this time. So they vary in height, and they also vary in places in width. Some places they go, you know, as wide as 5 meters. In some places, they go as narrow as 1.5 meters. But on average, they're probably about 3 meters wide.
Is there any chance that these were, in fact, not roads, but channels that carried water?
Well, absolutely. But how they carried water is the big surprise. They did not carry water because they were walls that kept the water inside them. They carried water because they were the connectors that carried and connected the energy from the energy-generating devices, the circles that generated the energy. And these walled structures were actually like the electromagnetic railway tracks that we see our trains run on today. So we have a spectacular example of a giant city, a metropolis, linked by these channels that connected all of them together and spread the energy from one to the other and allowed the movement of goods, including water, between all these circles for all kinds of purposes.
And okay, now how were you able to determine this about the energies?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. And we learn little bits from all over the place. In recent times, we discover people like John Keeley, who showed us levitation with sound frequency. We know that Tibetan monks are still using sound frequency levitation. They've been doing it for thousands of years. Royal Raymond Rife cured disease with sound frequency and other forms of frequency. In fact, I've recently discovered a new person like that in South Africa that is doing exactly the same, curing every possible disease you can imagine with sound and frequency. And Nikola Tesla gave us free energy in a form that he called radiant energy, and he got that from using the sound frequency from planet Earth to generate and convert into a different kind of frequency, which he then used as a source of energy. And it was by accident that we discovered that the stones in these stone ruins ring like bells. And when I say they ring like bells, I mean they ring like bells. For your listeners that want to confirm this, I suggest they go to my website. It's or to go to YouTube and look. I posted a little video clip where I show people how these stones actually ring like bells to really understand what I mean. Because I don't want them to call me a liar.
Well, I don't think they'll do that. All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll pick up there when we come back. So don't go away. Indeed, you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show, and my guest is Michael Tellinger. Michael, when we went away for break, you were just beginning to tell us about these stones ringing like bells.
Yeah, so I just want to, if your listeners want to go to YouTube and just type in stones that ring like bells in the search and window, and it'll bring up my little video clip where you'll see me ringing the stones, just to get an idea that it's spectacular. And it was by accident that we discovered that these stones ring like bells. And then suddenly, while we were clearing some of the sites, you know, of weeds and plants that were growing, and then picking up the stones that were underfoot, and accidentally bumping them and realizing, oh my goodness, listen to the sound that they make. And when I heard that, I suddenly went, hold on, this is not just an accident. All these stones in these stone circles, were chosen for very specific properties, and they were chosen for their acoustic properties. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. Just like Stonehenge, where the stones were chosen for the acoustic properties, and all pretty much every ancient civilization, we suddenly realized that these guys were using sound as a source of energy. And that opened up a whole new area and channel of discovery for us. And I went after this like a fox after a rabbit. It was just amazing. Just suddenly everything started falling into place and everything started to make sense. Why the structures were circular, why there were no entrances in these structures, therefore they weren't dwellings. And we realized that these stones were used in these circular devices to generate energy. And as Nikola Tesla explains, that the earth rings like a bell, and if you know how to harness that energy, you can use it. Suddenly we realized that these guys were doing exactly the same thing, except this goes back 300,000 years back in time. and everything suddenly went, okay, we're dealing with something we never, ever expected. And, you know, the reason I can say this with absolute confidence is because we've measured the energy, and we've measured about 14.5 gigahertz coming out of the stone circles at 72 decibels. And this is very loud, very strong source of energy that is still coming out of these stone circles thousands and thousands of years after they've been abandoned.
How would these ancient people have been able to harness that energy and convert it to useful energy? How do they change it from potential to working energy?
Well, first of all, we need to clarify a lot of things. We've been completely and utterly misguided in what we believe to be energy. When we talk about energy today, most people think of electricity. And electricity has been shown to us as it's difficult to generate electricity and it's expensive. And don't try this at home because it'll kill you and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what, unfortunately, what happened to Nikola Tesla. Because when Nikola Tesla discovered this free energy that everybody can tap into and use for everything, okay, and I'm talking everything, and frequency is the answer here. Frequency is energy. And when Nikola Tesla figured this out in 1902 already, and he gave it to the rest of the world, or he wanted to give it to the world, he was very quickly blocked and stopped from doing that because the people that wanted to give the world energy were obviously bankers and industrialists who wanted to charge for it, and therefore made sure that the free energy that was reintroduced by Tesla was very quickly removed from the mainframe. And so when we talk about energy, it's a different form of energy, and this we can see this energy work in various ways around us. You can boil water with 50 hertz frequency. This was done already in the 1940s by a guy called Peter Davey, an Australian inventor or musician who'd realized that sound frequency does a whole bunch of stuff, including boiling water. So we know that we can boil water with 50 hertz. How this is done still remains a bit of a mystery because Peter Davey has been sitting on this discovery since 1940, trying to become, you know, a billionaire from it, and hopefully he doesn't take this information to the grave with him. We know, for example, that 13.56 megahertz frequency will make neon lights shine. This is used in the wood drying business. So all we need to do is look around us and see how we use frequency around us in modern society, not realizing that it can be applied to everything. And this control of the human race through controlling of energy, I believe, is going to come to an end very, very soon, as soon as we get this information out there and make people go out and do more experiments and share this information with others. Now, this is clearly what these ancient civilizations are doing. They're also, it's important for me to add to this, Kevin, is that there are many stone tools and artifacts that I have been collecting for the last 3 years that point to this kind of activity. Especially cone-shaped stones that are not used for chopping or, you know, striking things, but beautiful cone-shaped stones of all sizes, from small ones to very large ones, and what are known as sacred stones in South Africa. And these sacred stones, they're also examples of it in my new book, Temples of the African Gods. These sacred stones are stones with these beautiful holes in them. They look like small wheels. They look like wheels made out of stone with these perfect concave holes made through the middle of the stone. And no one has been able to explain what these stones were for, why they were made, what they were used for, who made them. Now suddenly it all falls into place once you realize that these guys were there mining gold. They had advanced technology of sound frequency and using sound and frequency as a source of energy. And you realize that they used these sacred stones as frequency converters. They were like the screwdrivers and the spanners and the sockets of these ancient worksmen who used frequency to do all kinds of things. Levitation, crushing of the rock, separating the different materials from each other, purification of it, levitation of the material from one place to another, in between those what we call channels, right, those roads in between those walls, because that mm-hmm. was channeled between all the circles. So you're looking at one giant, the whole Southern African subcontinent was one giant energy grid, all connected, ready for use, and it was used for everything you can imagine. For the cultivation of food, for example, the crops, all the thousands of miles of agricultural crops, terraces, are linked to the stone circles and linked to these channels of energy, so they could actually channel that energy into the crop, the agricultural terraces, which are all made out of stone as well, the same stone, the extension of the structure, so they could enhance the growth of these plants. And for people that have been following the work and, you know, the esoteric work out there today, if you want to call it that, or the advanced work in the growth of plants and things, they will know that certain frequencies will enhance the production of crops several hundred times. So we see that these guys had an advanced knowledge and an understanding, an acute understanding of the use of energy in all its applications.
All right, now, we've been talking about this site being some 300,000 years old. In the course of your investigation, have you used either a Geiger counter, a scintillator, any other type of device that would help you to get some kind of dating on this thing?
Well, this is, again, another problem. And the reason we say around 300,000 years is from a compilation of little bits of information that we get. And as you start pulling them together, they all collectively point towards that 300,000-year mark, starting with the mitochondrial studies, the mitochondrial Eve studies, you know, DNA, mitochondrial DNA, that suggest that the first humans appeared on Earth around 300,000 years ago. It varies. Even 2 weeks ago, I was just coming to the United States, and Rice University just put out a paper that just, you know, once again supported that theory with their own studies on the mitochondrial DNA, that the first humans appeared on Earth at least 200,000 years ago. And so it keeps pushing towards that 300,000-year mark. The Sumerian tablets talk about it. They talk extensively about the different time spans of these ancient civilizations and where they lived and their mining operations in southern Africa. They refer to it as the Abzu, and they have specific names and terms for time units, and the Sumerian tablets refer to them as Shar, which are 3,600-year units of time.
Pardon me, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this.
United Kingdom, and you are listening to the fantastic Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and to my guest Michael Tellinger. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, you missed the first hour, you have my deep and abiding sympathy because you really did miss several universes of information. But we're glad you're here now, and I think you're going to be glad as well. All right, Michael, we were talking about the dating of... these ruins, and you were talking about how the dating has come from a compilation of data, and actually, I think using radiocarbon or anything like that is you know, you know how old a rock is, but you don't know how, you don't know when it was set into that position. And
exactly.
So I'm not sure that would be very instructive to do that. But, okay, 300,000 years ago, what does this site and the information, the data that you're getting from this site, what does it tell us that would enlighten us as to our origins?
Well, Kevin, you know, if I may, before I answer that, I was going to tell you about some of the other techniques that we use for dating, because I think it's important for people to have a sense of confidence in what we are doing, because it's not an easy task, this. It really is not. And I want people to feel comfortable that we are applying as many scientific principles and approaches as we can, and everything and anything that we find that could be used from a scientific perspective as a good argument for an age, we look at and we evaluate. Three more things that I need to mention is, first of all, the alignment to the rise of Orion, Orion's belt at Adam's calendar. And that's a very important one, because in our research, we find, many people that were familiar with ancient civilizations will know that pretty much all ancient civilizations were obsessed with Orion's belt, and then Sirius comes into the equation as well. And we realize that Sirius and Orion in some way were connected, and then we discover that Sirius is actually our binary star with the sun, our own sun. This is new scientific, scientifically proven discoveries very recently. And we realize that the ancient civilizations knew all this, and Orion was the obsession. You know, the Egyptian pyramids, the Aztec and the Mayan pyramids, the Chinese pyramids, all linked to the rise of Orion. In ancient African tradition, Orion plays a very important role of the rise of Orion as what the civilizations did at specific times. And at Adam's calendar, we find that there are three specific stones that have fallen over that were monoliths as part of the original circular structure that very distinctly points to the rise of Orion on the horizon. And to align that rise to Orion's belt, you've got to go back at least 160,000 years. And so all these little bits of information, at first our evaluation was about 75,000 years. Then our second evaluation with a different astronomer was, no, 75,000 years, this would align, but not exactly. You've got to go back at least 160,000 years. So every time we do more and more studies and evaluations, it pushes the date further back. Then we look at the erosion on some of the stones. Fortunately, one of the calendar stones, or unfortunately for the stone, but fortunately for our detection, one of the tips of the stone broke off and is lying right next to the calendar stone in the center of Adam's calendar. The erosion on that break is about a centimeter, maybe a bit more. And if you ask any geologist, this particular rock is known as dolerite. It's a very hard rock that incidentally also rings like a bell when you strike it. And the erosion there, if you ask geologists, they'll tell you, well, that erosion, you're looking at probably 100,000 years at least for that to happen. And so now we're starting to see, okay, the stars tell us more than 160,000 years. The erosion on that break tells us 100,000 years plus when the break occurred. So the site is a lot older than that, obviously. And then we start looking at the actual alignments at Adam's calendar. The north, south, east, west cardinal points are out by 3.25 degrees from the current north, south, east, west alignments. Now, this is a big shock to the system. These guys didn't make mistakes. And what this points to is that Adam's calendar was constructed at a time when the angle of the Earth, the axis of the Earth, which is currently sitting at 24.5 degrees, was at a different angle, and that angle was out by 3.5 degrees, further out, leaning out, more, towards the horizontal. Now, there is currently, in current scientific and astrophysics circles, there is no model that allows for that kind of deviation. Not the Milankovitch cycles, none of these things allow for that, an extra 3.25 degrees. And this throws a huge question mark as to how old is this? When was it built? And I believe this all links and ties into the origins of this, of Adam's calendar, which I believe is, we all believe is the flagship among these millions of stone ruins. Remember, there are more than 10 million of these. Adam's calendar was the flagship there. And it was constructed at a time before all of this is wiped out, which we believe was what happened by the flood, about 12 to 13,000 years ago. I believe that the same event that caused the flood was the same event that was so strong, the geophysical forces were so strong, that it actually also shifted the Earth's axis from where it was, which was out by 3.25 degrees, to where it is today. And this is still, there's a lot more work to be done there, a lot more scientific analysis, but clearly we're dealing with some really old and ancient sites that we don't quite understand. And then finally, we get to what I believe are the, so is the holy of holies in our argument, if you want to call it that, and that is the patina. The patina growth on these specific stones. Now, the patina is like, you could call it the skin of the rock or the stone. Mm-hmm. And I show this with wonderful examples in my presentations. So people that do have a chance to come, I'd really urge you come so that you'll really understand what I'm talking about. The patina is like, when you take the stone, which is known as hornfels, these stones that ring like bells, it's a very specific geological formation in southern Africa, and when you break that stone, it starts to grow this patina, or the skin of the rock. It starts to grow back on the surface, on the break, or on the just general surface of the stone that gets exposed to the elements. But this patina grows really slowly. Currently, our scientific evaluations are that it grows at about 5,000 years per microscopic layer. So when you find a tool or an artifact that has clearly been created for a specific purpose and manipulated, and it is totally covered by patina of 2 to 3 millimeters or a centimeter thick, we know we're dealing with an artifact that was made a long, long time ago, and not just a few hundred years or a few thousand years ago. We're dealing with 100,000, 200, 300,000 years ago. And these are the kind of bits of evidence that we and pieces that we pull together to start constructing an hypothesis of how old these structures are. And it's really quite spectacular. I've collected hundreds of tools and artifacts that I display in a little museum that I've built in the town that I stay, called Waterfallburfen in South Africa. And it's a spectacular little display that is just crammed together in a little into a little museum that normally would take up a huge amount of space. But, you know, people come in there and it just takes their breath away.
All right. Now, let's get back to the question of what does this site do in terms of enlightening us about our origins? Anything at all? Do we get any clues from this site about the origins of our species?
Yeah, it certainly does. It links, it provides the evidence of what the Sumerian tablets talk about, and in fact what I believe the Bible talks about as well. Sumerian tablets talk about the Anunnaki, these beings that arrived on Earth looking for gold, and they found it in great abundance, as we know, and they started mining it, feverishly. And they were known as the Sumerian tablets call them the Anunnaki. And the Bible calls the giants of the Bible, that controlled and messed with humanity, calls them the Anakim. So I believe that the Anakim, biblical Anakim, and the Anunnaki are actually the same group of beings. there are a few bridges that one needs to cross and links that one needs to make for this to start making sense for people that haven't been exposed to this before. But first of all, the biblical word Elohim, or the biblical word for God, the Hebrew word for God in the original Bible was Elohim. And Elohim is a plural. It's a plural for the word gods, the gods. And we realize that every time you read the word God in the Bible, you need to replace it with its original meaning, the gods. And very quickly you realize that the Bible talks about the same Elohim, or the gods, as the Sumerian tablets talks about, and all the other ancient cultures talk about. And these gods were obsessed with gold. They wanted gold, and they were mining gold, and they created the humans in their own image to help them mine the gold. And this is what we find in absolutely spectacular abundance in southern Africa, is this gold mining activity. The last count of ancient gold mines in South Africa, and this is just South Africa, this does not include Zimbabwe, Botswana, or Mozambique. In just South Africa, there was an attempt to close some of these ancient gold mines to prevent illegal gold mining, and they started counting these gold mines, and they stopped counting when they reached 75,000 gold mines.
Okay. That's a bunch. That is a lot of gold mines. That's 75,000, and they're still open and working.
Yeah, and they stopped counting at that stage, because so you must triple that or quadruple that or tenfold it. That's how many gold mines there are or were in southern Africa. Okay, and this is just one small area of South Africa that they counted those mines. So you need to put all these things into perspective, because people have no idea. When I say we're dealing with a vast ancient civilization that were active in mining gold, they don't understand what I'm talking about until they really get a closer look at this. This is huge, bigger than anything we've ever imagined in our lives.
All right. Earlier you were talking about these circular structures. And the channels, the walled streets or channels that connect them. And you said that these were not used as living quarters. The people did not live in there. And you also told us there was a population in this city or settlement up to 50 million. So if they're not living in these circular areas, where are they living?
That's a very good question. We're not quite sure. At this stage, the biggest mystery of all of this is, where are the human remains? That is actually the greatest mystery of all here, because we're finding physical evidence of, you know, gold mines, these circular structures that were used for the gold mining activity, for the generation of energy. And I must also tell you, we must come back to the shapes, to some of the shapes of these structures, because that's very interesting. But the mystery is that we have no evidence or physical, you know, skeletons of people, no remains. There are two possible reasons for that, I believe. Two most obvious reasons are that either they burnt the dead and they scattered the ashes, but you know they probably wouldn't have been able to burn everybody. And if they were if this civilization was destroyed by the flood, it would have, you know, killed millions of people. And then those remains of the skeletons will be buried under meters and meters of sediment and soil and sand. So I think they lie a lot deeper than we ever imagined, and we need to start digging a lot deeper than anyone has ever dug. You must also understand that there has been no real attempt whatsoever at any serious archaeological digs to look at this or excavate any of these sites. There have been very, very surface, feeble attempts to dig maybe a meter or maybe a meter and a half deep, and then they stop digging. I think the deepest they've gone is about 1.5 meters.
Well, there's also another possibility. Possibility, you mentioned that it's your opinion that whatever caused the Great Flood, the same cosmic cataclysm, whatever it was, shifted the Earth's axis, I believe you said, by 3.25 degrees.
Yeah.
There's every possibility that that area may have not just been flooded, but may have experienced a massive tsunami. And that population may be far to the east or west of there, depending on which way the tsunami was headed.
Yeah, that's also possible. There's another possibility, Kevin, but then it starts getting into the metaphysical area, which is fine. I'm comfortable with that, but not everybody is always comfortable with that. But there's a possibility that these people just simply dematerialized, or they were caused to dematerialize by those who understand the use and the manipulation of frequency. After all, physical matter is just the manipulation of frequency, and the effect of frequency creates physical matter. So you can dematerialize things through understanding and manipulation of frequency. This we're starting to understand very clearly now.
And to say, well, you would think if they had that technology, they could have just materialized gold.
Well, that's also a possibility. And it looks like they started doing that in later years, but not in the beginning. These are all very interesting questions and certainly challenge our understanding and what we our levels of imagination. But gold is inextricably linked to this planet. It seems that gold is the energy source of this planet. From ancient texts and the Sumerian tablets especially, we get a very clear sense that gold is not easily found, is not a common substance in our solar system and in our galaxy, most likely, and that this planet has an abundance of it, and these guys came to Earth looking for gold, and they found it.
Any idea, any clue as to why they were so enamored with gold?
To start off with, it was a matter of survival. This is what my current understanding is. Pretty much like, we have climatic change in this on this planet. I'm not talking about global warming, I'm talking about climate change. And it has been shown very clearly by a lot of people now that every single planet in our solar system is undergoing dramatic climate change, not just our planet. Mm-hmm. So it was climate change that caused their planet to push them to the verge of extinction, and they needed to do something to protect themselves against the deadly effects of the cosmic rays and all the different rays that come out of the from the cosmos and the galactic center. And they decided, they found that gold was the most suitable source for that, or material for that. In a nano particle form, and that's what I understand from the Sumerian translations when they tell us that gold was a substance that they chose, that they wanted to grind to the finest powder, and suspended high up in the heavens to prevent the rays from destroying their atmosphere. I believe when they talk about grinding the gold to the finest powder, that's actually a bad translation or bad description by people who did not really understand the advanced technology. I believe they were talking about nanotechnology and using gold in its nano form, which we now are starting to use in the most spectacular ways. Nanotechnology has taken the world by storm. Suddenly we see nanotechnology popping its head out everywhere. We're using it in bloody washing powders and washing machines and detergents, and we're using it in structures, blending nanotechnology with synthetically generated DNA that we can program to grow into any kind of shape and take on any kind of shape, and mix that DNA with nano gold or nano anything, and it'll give us in its finished product the appearance of being made from gold. But when you cut it, or you break it, or you tear it, it'll automatically, instinctively repair itself because it's DNA. It's a living organism. It takes us back to the sci-fi movies and to Terminator, where we're dealing with cybernetic organisms. We're dealing with living with living DNA and nanoparticles of minerals, gold, platinum, crystal, whatever, silica, you choose. And this is spectacular stuff that we're doing today that it seems that these guys were doing a long time ago as purely as a survival for themselves on their own planet. But then they discovered what we have just recently rediscovered, the monoatomic properties of gold and I guess also the other platinum group metals. And they realized that gold is basically an inexhaustible source of energy in its monoatomic form, or what many people refer to as white powder of gold or manna from heaven. And suddenly you open a whole new chapter on this whole human history, and you realize that there's a whole lot more stuff that is linked to gold and the many stories of the Bible than we could have ever imagined.
All right, so let me ask you, in terms of our origin, were we, for lack of a better word, engineered here on this planet? Or were we engineered elsewhere and placed on this planet?
Well, that's a double-edged sword question, because many spiritual teachers and psychics will tell you that there are certain parts of our human population that were engineered on other planets and brought to Earth. I'm not going to go into detail there, but there are certain groups of our population that we are told that were brought here from other planets. It also seems that there have been other advanced beings and human-like beings on this planet for millions of years. All you need to do is read Michael Cremo's phenomenal book called Hidden Archaeology or Forbidden Archaeology to realize how little we know of the history of our planet, that life and various beings, human-like beings, have existed on this planet for millions and millions of years and gone in cycles. But what we are obsessed with right now is the origins of the humankind and Homo sapiens, which is, you know, absolutely we have the right to be obsessed with that, to try and figure out who the hell we are as a species and why are we so confused and why are we so militant and so forth. And I think we're getting very close to starting to understand that. So I think that from...
Okay, Michael, we have to step away for a break, and we'll pick up there when we come back. Of the music used here on the Kevin Smith Show comes from the great independent artists at GarageBand.com. Go to GarageBand.com and check out the fabulous selection they have of great independent music by great independent artists. GarageBand.com. Check it out. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Michael Tellinger. Michael, what I would like to do is open up the telephone lines. Well, something weird just happened. The microphone dipped and the microphone is back. Anyway, Michael, what I'd like to do is open up the telephone lines and allow our audience to join us with their questions and or comments if they have any. Ladies and gentlemen, the telephone numbers are as follows. The main number here in the studio is 623-444-5889. If you are in the USA or Canada, I also have a toll-free number. If you need to call me toll-free, you may do so. It is 888-223-4599. If you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, in other words, if you're in the USA or Canada, close your ears. This is not for you. Okay? But if you're outside of the USA or Canada, you can call us on the main number, or because I do not have a toll-free international line, I have set up something called Flash Messages, and you can go to my website, click where it says Flash Message, right on the right side of the graphic about tonight's show, and you can send me your question or comment in that way, all right? So the phone lines are open for a few minutes. We'll see if anyone wishes to join us, and if they do, we will take their questions or comments. And otherwise, Michael, you and I will continue to talk. Now, you said there had not been any serious archaeological work done on this site. What would it take to make that happen?
Well, first of all, money. We need the permits from the local authority to allow us to go and do an archaeological dig. From our experience and our research, we believe we know where the main sites are that we would like to dig. There are thousands of them, obviously. Look, Kevin, this thing is so large that tomorrow morning I could give every single archaeologist in the world a job, and there would not be enough archaeologists in the world. That's how large this entire area is. It's just not possible to excavate it. It's like saying we're going to excavate Texas. You know what I mean? That's what we're dealing with.
Wow.
So it's huge. You know, it covers most of South Africa, all of Zimbabwe, large parts of Botswana, large parts of Mozambique. It's the same size, if not larger, than the whole of Texas.
Wow.
So it's huge, you know. It's not just a site, you know. So when you say a site, you're dealing with expansive, vast areas of planet Earth that are covered with millions and millions of stone ruins that have just now, you know, civilization is gone. So what we need to do to excavate this, first of all, we need permission from the South African government, from the body that controls it. We are about to lodge those documents. We need archaeologists that have international status that are prepared to come and work with us, either free of charge or find funding somewhere so we can pay them for these digs. We will take them to the sites where we believe they are.
Okay. Well, I am not surprised. And I think I have figured out what causes that. And perhaps we can fix it. So, anyway, what we're going to do is see if we can get our guest back online. I don't think in this case that anything nefarious just happened. I think it was just a problem, actually, with the way we have a computer set up. I've been noticing that it happens at about the same time, and it does not happen every night. So let's see if we can get our guest back on the line here. Okay. All right. We've got him back. I was just telling the audience that I don't think that represents anything nefarious, anybody cutting us off. I think I have figured out that has happened several times since I moved the studio. And I think I figured it out. I think it's something in the, and I know which something, in the setup in the computer. Anyway, so if you had every archaeologist on Earth show up in the morning, you would have a job for them if you had the money.
Yeah.
But you have got to get the permits to do this. And do you think the permits are going to be issued?
Yeah, look, they'll issue us the permits. They can't withhold the permits. We need to find, we found one archaeologist so far that's on the same wavelength as we are in Austria. The South African archaeologists, unfortunately, are just not on the same wavelength. They live in the textbooks that they've been studying, and so they're at the moment, their ability to grasp what we're dealing with is not quite there. Secondly, we need more archaeologists that, you know, to come forward and say, look, we'd love to get involved. And most importantly, we need funding. We need those wonderful donor organizations or funding organizations that fund these kind of projects around the world to pay attention and say, listen, we love what you're doing, or we're really interested in what you're doing. We'll support you, we'll fund the archaeological digs and so forth. And then I believe that we have about three sites that within a very short space of time, I believe the first month of digging, will probably deliver some of the most convincing archaeological evidence of ancient human civilizations, and possibly what I truly believe is the connections between humans and the Anunnaki. I believe we know where they are, these graves that these individuals are buried, and we need to dig those up. Also start doing core sample drilling into some of the terraces to see what kind of crops these people were cultivating, what animals they had, if there's pollen, any fossilized evidence of stuff. You know, there's just so much exciting work to be done. We need funding for scientific experiments in laboratory to do proper erosion, simulated erosion testing on some of the stones, and then also getting proper, and this will make us the first team in the world to actually do accurate studies on the rate of the growth of the patina. So we're absolutely accurate in our estimation of the age of some of these artifacts and the tools. So, you know, to answer your question bluntly, it takes money like everything else right now. We need funding. Because right now, most of the funding, well, all the funding is coming from myself, from, you know, traveling around the world and doing my talks and selling books, and Johan Heiner from his own pocket. And that, unfortunately, is not too deep. So mm-hmm. we need assistance on various levels.
All right, now, you said that you think you've identified the location of the graves, and I want to clarify this, graves of the Anunnaki?
Correct. We have one particular site, which we call the Stone Altar. It is actually part of the Adams Calendar Precinct, or the whole stretch that runs for about 2 kilometers, along the edge of the cliff that you then find Adam's calendar at, which we know now is Enki's calendar. And under the stone altar, there is definitely something buried. We know, first we knew this from psychics, a lot of psychics that came through, they told us over and over again, there's something buried underneath here. Then Kreta Mutwa, the South African, revered shaman and Sangoma, wise man, medicine man, he's the custodian of ancient knowledge of the African people. He told us that there's an important ancient king that's been buried there. And then thirdly, we did some infrared photography that was done for us as a favor, and the infrared photography shows without a shadow of doubt that something is buried there about 3 meters below the ground, and it's about 3 meters tall. Or 3 meters long. And we suspect, based on my reverse engineering the clues, that this could be and probably is the youngest son of Enki, who is known by the name of Dumuzi. And the Sumerian tablets tell us that when Dumuzi died, his beloved was Inanna. Now, Dumuzi and Inanna were like the Romeo and Juliet of the Sumerian tablets. They were inseparable. They were just like, you know, the Romeo and Juliet story, basically. And when Dumuzi died, which incidentally happens after the flood, and the Sumerian tablets, once again, are very clear in the event of his death. And then they describe what happens afterwards, and that's that Inanna, his beloved, who later incidentally became the goddess and the ruler of India and the whole Indus Valley civilization, she took Dumuzi's body and took it to the deep Abzu. Now, we've already established that the deep Abzu is in southern Africa where the gold came from, and Inanna buried Dumuzi. And this is the description in the Sumerian tablets. She buried him at her father's special place on the edge of a cliff below a pile of stones facing east so that his soul would await, be everlasting or await everlasting life or something like that. And we believe that this is this certainly indicates that this particular grave is possibly the grave of the Sumerian Dumuzi. And that's going to be very exciting to go there and dig and find what is actually buried there, because we know something is there.
Well, and you said that whatever it is approximately 3 meters in length. That's approximately 9 feet.
9 feet, yeah. So we're dealing with what the Bible calls the giants, you know, or the Anakim, or the Anunnaki. And this is just one area that we think we need to dig. There are various others. And this is just very exciting. Once we start digging, I know that it's going to attract the attention of the entire archaeological world and historical world, especially once we start finding some interesting fossils and artifacts. I believe, I must tell you that my personal belief is that once we start digging, we're going to start finding large amounts of skeletons buried deep. My guess is between 10 and 15 meters below the soil. And no one's ever dug that deep because of the sediment, the flood,
mm-hmm.
Of the flood. And I believe that those early skeletons that we find are, if there's any DNA material, that has survived.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back for Final Approach right after this.
Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach, and we're talking with Michael Tellinger. Michael, we were talking about the possibility that you have located the burial place of Enki's youngest son. What effect do you think it will have on the world if you are able to excavate that and discover that indeed it is who you think it is?
Well, the obvious answer is that it will put aside any doubt about the rest of the information that we get from the Sumerian tablets, and it'll force people and historians and archaeologists who have reservations about the validity of the Sumerian tablets. Why they have those reservations, I still don't quite understand, because there seems to be this selective approach. But it'll cast aside any doubt that we have this ancient history and link to these advanced beings known as the Anunnaki, who came to Earth, manipulated some DNA, created a slave species called the Lulu Amelu, the primitive worker, as the Sumerian tablets call it, and created the human race as their slaves, their slave species, to mine, to work in the gold mines, and the early gold mines that then became other mines and created this entire mining fraternity that we're still continuing today. Nothing has changed. We're still slaves to the same to the descendants of these early Anunnaki. We mine more. There's more mining going on this planet than ever before, and not much has really changed. It's just most people have been dumbed down, and their attention has been diverted from what's going on, and they've been given things called democracy and freedom, so-called freedom and capitalism, and created the wonderful stuff to distract us from what's really going on, it'll create a lot of heated debate, and it'll probably create a lot of friction between established dogma and what's really going out there in the world.
All right, if you find in fact a 9-foot skeleton as old as that would be, as old as you're talking about, the chances of finding any DNA of any kind would be very slim, wouldn't it?
It probably would, but remember that the skeleton we're looking at is probably only about 12,000 years old. Now that's old, but it's not as old as 300,000 years. And it all depends on the conditions under which the skeleton was laid to rest. So, or how it was covered. So it's difficult to say right now. There might be other parts of the body that are somehow have contained DNA material. But what I was telling you before the break is what I'm really excited about is if we find other skeletons that are, of the early humans, the early prototype human beings that I believe were cloned. Incidentally, the reason why Adam's calendar is so important and so sacred among the ancient African tradition, according to Kratos Mutwa, is because at Adam's calendar, or Enki's calendar, is where the actual fertilization process took place of the new species. There was the Anunnaki, the 7 Anunnaki females, were actually fertilized and impregnated with the fertilized eggs of this new species, and they were the surrogate mothers for this new species to start off with, until they started cloning the new species en masse. But what I'm excited about is that when we do find these skeletons of these early prototype humans, we'll probably find that they only have 22 pairs of chromosomes. And the 23rd chromosome was only added once Eve was cloned from Adam's rib. And once again, we get the story beautifully told in the Sumerian tablets. In the Bible, that story is reduced to pretty much one line. And in the Sumerian tablets, it is described in great detail how Adam was put into a deep sleep, and part of his rib was removed. The essence of his rib was removed, which I believe is probably the bone marrow. It's the quickest way to bone marrow in your body. And then from the bone marrow, they took the DNA and they created a female species by attaching the X chromosomes and manipulating the DNA, and then creating the male and the female, different species, and then put them into the Garden of Eden to see if they would get on. So the Garden of Eden wasn't this wonderful, holy kind of wonderful place, It was really an observation laboratory, they were lab rats being observed to see if they would get on, if the female wouldn't eat the male, like in other species.
We have a flash message that I want to read from New Zealand. Rick writes, "Hi, Kevin and Michael. Have any languages, artistic or pictorial tablets, carvings, etc., been found to help interpret something about those people?"
Yes, the answer to that is very quickly yes, not just one, but thousands. We have thousands of incredible petroglyphs carved into very, very hard rock known as andesite. It's the same kind of rock as diorite, for those people that know diorite, which is some of the Egyptian statues of the pharaohs were carved out of diorite, that very black kind of dark black kind of It's a very hard stone. It's like the second hardest stone after diamond, often quoted as that. And these petroglyphs, incidentally, we get beautiful petroglyphs of the Ankh, the Egyptian Ankh. So we now know that the South African civilization used the Ankh long before the rise of Egypt. We have the crosses and circles that we thought were Sumerian symbols. We have many, many other symbols that we now that place the origins of civilization here in Southern Africa. It seems to place it there with these first humans. And the knowledge of all this kind of stuff, and they carved their information into the stone, into this rock. The reason why we believe it's so old, once again, closer to the 300,000-year mark, is from the erosion on these petroglyphs and these carvings, because it's in this very hard rock called andesite. The erosion is so spectacular that it tells us instantly that it's very, very old. So yeah, there are many, many, and you know, spirals and other symbols that we see in other ancient scripts, like the Indus Valley script. There are symbols that we find in the Indus Valley script. In the runes, we see similar symbols in the runes, etc. It's just amazing stuff. Yeah.
Whenever you get out to Taos, if you have time, get some of the local people to take you out to see petroglyphs carved by, we say Native Americans, but they predate any any Native Americans that we know about. Pardon me.
Yeah.
A little sinus situation. But it predates any of the Native Americans that we actually know about. And they're very similar to what you're describing. Man, I don't know if I'm going to survive this sinus attack. But I'll try. Okay, that's better. Very, very similar. The spirals, the cross in a circle. You know, and you wonder, how did they make it all the way from South Africa to here? Well, as I die right here on air, my friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want, just keep coming back again and again and again. If I'm here, we'll do another show.